This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Among the new courses on offer this term are new Katana lighting training, a world first with Matt Leonard. Included in that is free VPN access to a full version of Katana, along with many other key programs to help you learn, such as Arnold, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and just heaps more. All there to help you take your career to the next level. Check it out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we're going to episodic television, and not just any episodic television that certainly I watched as a kid, now my kids watch, and that is the English, the BBC classic Doctor Who. And I'm joined by Ed Moore. Welcome back, Ed. How are you?
I'm very good, Mike. Thank you for having me again.
Now, Ed obviously is a DOP, but not only that, he's worked recently on episodic television, in particular with our good friends, the team at Red Dwarf. And so, always keen to get your perspective, Ed, and of course having that episodic background and that is very interesting. Though, of course, that was comedy. This is, comedy drama, let's see. And we're also joined by a newcomer, Zap. How are you, sir?
I'm awesome.
Now, we wanted to get you on for a couple of reasons. Zap, you and I have been friends for years, and I have a great respect for the work that you do. But apart from anything else, I was lavishly quoting or misquoting you on a recent Hobbit episode. And somebody said, why don't you just get Zap on instead of saying what Zap said? And I went, okay, that's a good idea.
Works for me.
So let's start by asking, are you guys Doctor Who fans? Did you actually watch it as a kid, Zap?
Actually, I'm kind of a late bloomer to the whole Who thing in the sense that it was actually my son who started to watch it. And once he's like, Dad, can you get me this episode of this and get that this season? I was like, okay, what's this thing? And he started watching it religiously. I think I have a vague memory of Doctor Who from being a kid, maybe something being on some TV. But then, you know, there is some internet strip of some kind of internet cartoon. I don't think it's XKCD, but it's maybe Penny Arcade or some of these others, where this is one strip. There, a person is saying, this Doctor Who thing, I heard about it. I should maybe watch one episode. And then it just says, like, you know, 45 minutes later or a month later or whatever, the person is totally, you know, drowned in Who things. And that's pretty much me, really, because when I started really watching it, I really started out with the going through all the new series stuff, and then I actually dug into some of the old stuff, and some of it is kind of painful to watch on a technical level, but it's still fun. It's still the Doctor. So, but yeah, I'm kind of a late bloomer here.
And what about you, Ed?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, in the UK,
you're English,
gather
right?
Around, yeah, we gather around with the Queen every Saturday night and watch it with the corgis and everything. Now, I did kind of only get into the reboot, and even then, probably only from they kind of started from series one again with Chris Eccleston, and I guess from about series three of this reboot, I really got into it, and now it's kind of obligatory. It's one of the biggest dramas shooting in the UK, so, you know, professionally I like to keep an eye on it and kind of what the big guys are doing. But I'm a huge fan. I mean, I do totally geek out about it. It's fantastic.
I don't think I would be probably a big fan of the new one. Not that I dislike it or anything, but I mean, I watched it as a kid. But I got brought back to it by my children, one of whom is a complete Who fanatic. And so much so that recently around Christmas time in Sydney, we had a Doctor Who Symphonic Spectacular at the Sydney Opera House. And I have to say that was great fun. Mm-hmm. So I took my daughter, and we were in the concert hall of the Sydney Opera House, and they played with the full orchestra the music from Doctor Who while playing clips. But not only that, they had a lot of the modern day, I guess, Daleks and all the kind of stuff in the audience coming out. At one stage, the Daleks actually took over the opera house and had the conductor at plunger point. And
exterminate!
Yeah,
exterminate.
But it was even funnier than that. You know, they had very elaborate and clever things, weeping angels hidden up in the ceiling and just a spectacular light show. So it really was both great to hear that music and a very unusual experience, but superbly done. And of course, that came from England. It was originally, I presume, a what do you call it? The proms, is it? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember there was there have been a few kind of big nationwide tours of Doctor Who stuff and yeah, kind of big sound and light extravaganza type thing. So maybe it's the same thing that's been shipped over.
Yeah, and this was not like a tacky thing. This was actually because it was mainly the music. It wasn't, you know, like a stage show. It was the other guys turning up was sort of incidental to the music, which gave me a new appreciation of the music, because of course I don't normally focus on the music especially on the visual effects on the show, but it was great to see that. But I learned a bit along the way. For those of you that aren't so familiar with Doctor Who, or perhaps those of you that is there such a person? I don't know. But it's 50th year, so there's another reason for us doing the show. 50 years is an incredible time. Obviously, it was broken in the middle there, in the sense that they stopped production and then restarted it up again. I think the Christmas special is what we're going to focus on, and that really is an institution. When you start talking about watching it with the Queen, I actually thought you were serious at first, because then there is that tradition of Christmas. You have the Queen's message, and then you have kind of a lot of the big dramas doing Christmas specials, because it's the middle of your kind of high point of rating season, isn't it, Ed?
Yeah, sure. Because everyone's just at home eating chocolates.
Right. Whereas for us, it's summer holidays, and normally there's nothing on television. But in this day of the internet, they have to actually broadcast the episodes here in Australia almost simultaneously with what they're doing in the UK. Otherwise, they get pirated far too much. As a consequence, we certainly saw that Christmas special right when it came out. And in the lead up to that Christmas special, as you may have seen, Ed, there were a couple of prequely kind of little teaser videos. Well, they're almost like mini episodes that gave some backstory to the main Christmas show that sort of set up a couple of the things. And I think we'll include those in our discussion. I think it's great that the BBC so wholeheartedly embraces the second screen, the idea of, you know, webisodes and, you know, ties that in with the main show without spoiling it. You didn't have to see those to get an idea, but for obviously for fans, getting those, you know, 3 or 4 minute bits a week or two ahead really started to whet the appetite. I seem to remember there was an enormous Christmas special, though I didn't see it, with Kylie Minogue, an Australian, in the David Tennant years as well.
Voyage of the Damned.
Right. And was that any good?
It's pretty damn good. Yeah. It crashes into the Titanic, but the Titanic in space, so it's kind of cool.
What I've been struck with when I've been watching episodes of this seventh season, but also the ones preceding it, is that it's almost ridiculous how much sort of episodic effects they're sort of jamming into some of the episodes. For example, there's an episode where just about every baddie in the world seems to be taking on the Doctor at some point, or not just a few Daleks, but about 10,000, I think it was, in the Asylum of the Daleks. Just ridiculous amount of kind of visual effects. How they're going to top that for the 50th is a question I'm going to put to you, Ed. Do you have any idea what be, and I'm not saying this from that I expect you to leak, but as a guess, is there anywhere they've got left to go? Because, I mean, they've already got the guy married off, he's dead umpteen times. As a writer, you know, you've had every villain brought back, every companion brought back. There's almost nowhere for them to go for this 50th. They're promising it'll be a cracker.
And they've blown up the universe like at least 400 times, right, and brought it back again. Yeah, there is, I don't know if you know about, there's a whole other drama now being shot about the creation of Doctor Who. So I think that's one of the things they're doing for the 50th anniversary.
That's almost a dramatization of the actual show, right? Rather than the show itself. Yeah,
and I think that's about the original series and how that got kind of pitched. But I think that'll be really interesting as well. That's being written by Mark Gatiss, who wrote a lot of the sort of current series. But yeah, in terms of where they go, and they always seem to find somewhere that's always a surprise. They kind of have got a license now to be so extreme. Like, you so expect almost anything, and you know, you're kind of bracket for how much you'll expect and believe and buy into with Doctor Who is so wide now that I think they've given themselves a huge playground to take it wherever they want.
So if there was a particularly interesting episode where they had a sort of a time paradox, as they tend to do in that fabric of that very well worn.
Never happened.
Yes. And they had Winston Churchill with blimps.
Timey-wimey.
And that was an extraordinary piece of sort of visual effects. On paper, I would have been terrified to see that script if I'd been sitting there looking at it. It was an enormous amount of stuff they had to pack into that episode.
Oh, yeah, there's quite a lot. You're referring to where all the time is happening at once. Basically, you have dinosaurs flying through the air. There is, blimps and stuff. It's a historical setting with modern tones. It's a complete mix of everything. And, I know the mill is doing a lot of the effects work, and I can imagine the look on their faces when this script comes in. It's like, yeah, we want everything at once in every shot.
I remember the one where he's with the Pandorica, which was what, season 6, is that correct? Where the Doctor's kind of trapped in this thing, and there's a point where every sort of baddie he's ever faced turns up at once to try and kill him, and it's just, you can just imagine the script say, you know, and then the Doctor looks up to the sky and there's 10 billion spaceships, and they're going, well, this isn't like a $200 million summer like movie. This is the episode.
Yeah,
the
scene at Stonehenge. Where
that's what I'm
resembled Close Encounters of the Third Kind on an episodic television budget. But before we hit the visual effects, I want to just flag, as we always do, a couple more things about the plot. And one of the things I've been really impressed with in Doctor Who, and I think is terrific, is actually a theme that happens in many shows, but they do it particularly well. You expect an A arc, you know, a sort of an arc that starts at the beginning of an ep and finishes by the end of it, and you expect a couple of B arcs going along. Maybe sometimes they're providing the comic relief. It seems like Doctor Who's very good at C arcs, which span sometimes over multiple series. And I think the River Pond kind of thing was a spectacular example of that, of having the Doctor's wife moving through time backwards, having episodes where one character didn't know who the other one was, and then discovering, in fact, where Riversong came from, and then that whole tie-in with Pine. It was very, very well thought out. And they've done other things like that.
But is it, though? That's so interesting. If you read, one of the things I actually like with Doctor Who, you could kind of tell that they're really making it up as they go along, and they don't care. And that's so refreshing. It's when you want to be this, ponderously, pretentious, like saying, oh, I planned this all along, clearly. I mean, when they put in River Song, the first episode, of course he had some kind of plan, it's going to do something, but there was no way he had it all planned out. And then, threw stuff together, and it's not all perfect. Like the episode Let's Kill Hitler is really one where they really rush through a bunch of River Song stuff that I really would have wanted maybe happen over multiple episodes and be kind of less like, holy crap, we need to get through all this stuff all at once. But that's the kind of the beauty also, that they kind of like, we threw this in it because it's cool, and you don't really care because it's Doctor Who, it's whimsical, it's fun, and they can always reset the timeline later if it didn't work, it's all wibbly wobbly,
There's a real enjoyment, I think, as well. Certainly, I think it's so event television in the UK that it's not like some box set thing that you gorge on in your own time. Like, most people seem to watch it, on the day when it's transmitted. And then there's just, especially through that whole River Song thing, there was just so much kind of like enjoyment and chat between everyone I knew, certainly, about how they're going to kind of work this out. Like, you're almost alongside the writers kind of figuring it out. How is this all going to come together? And unlike maybe Lost, which did kind of get a little bit,
Polar Bear, yeah.
Yeah, this kind of Doctor Who, as I say, has this license where you kind of just buy it in the end, and they do come up with just all these spectacular stuff and stuff like, in this series as well, the whole thing where we can't go back to that time because there's now, the time in the area of this point is a bit rubbish, and you go, okay, whatever, fine, that's great. Everyone wants the drama, and we're not sort of too fussed about whether you actually write it down on paper, whether it actually all joins together too much.
And it also ties into this extra because on the season 6 DVDs, there's a bunch of little hidden Easter eggs with additional little like 2-minute episodes with the Doctor and River Song and various things in the TARDIS, like that as just yet another layer on top of this, and you go like, holy crap, that too fit into this, and your brain just go kablooey and you just love it.
And I don't think we should underestimate the smartness of Stephen Moffat, who writes all this. I've seen several interviews with him where he did certainly a pretty good job of convincing me that he at least had a plan all the way through of how this stuff was all going to connect together. So either he's got an amazing poker face or he's a genius.
I'm completely blanking on the location of the previous secret word that kept on coming up. that kept on coming up until the final reveal.
The Bad Wolf stuff?
Thank you, Bad Wolf. Thank you. I was sitting here kind of completely blanking on it. See, Bad Wolf was set up for
extremely
a long time in
advance. Poorly translated to Norwegian, by the way, but okay, that's a different story.
But nevertheless, it did feel like this was a terrific C, if not D, arc that was happening. You know, for those that were paying attention, you started to dawn on it, and then for those that weren't, it became more and more obvious. But it would be great if you were a super fan to then go back and try and find all the previous earlier references to it. And for those that don't know, it was a recurring set of words, I guess, that would appear in different places for different reasons. And you know, an alien language would have it, and someone would translate it, and that's what it would be. And it all sort of tied in by the end. And I got to say, for some of that stuff, I do think. You know, I'm with you, Ed. It doesn't matter. It's just fun. I mean, I found the Hitler episode pretty funny, really. And, you know.
Yeah, it's great.
And I didn't really care. There are occasions that I find them mind-numbingly annoying because they just seems like, for no apparent reason, they're doing stuff. The dinosaurs in space seem to be solely a reason to have a dinosaur in space. The rest of it just made no sense whatsoever.
What's wrong with dinosaurs in space?
Yeah, but I think that's the episode. It's like, pitch me dinosaurs in space. Here's my checkbook. There you go. Go make it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, whatever. That'll be fine. And at some point, I think there's a deliberate nod to the audience. Rick, she sort of says, I've got dinosaurs in a spaceship. You know, it's like, oh, isn't that enough? Yeah. Like, that's all you want, right?
But so it is a mixture, though. I mean, at the same time, there's a real awareness of the history of the show, and even in you know, there are references in it that if you're a huge fan of the sort of original series, which I'm in passing, but I read about these connections and things. I think the Christmas special, the whole kind of plot with the snow creature thing, which is almost like a B plot in that episode because it's mostly about the new companion, you know, that whole plot is from, I understand, an original series plot about, and there's all kinds of links to do with the underground in London and all that kind of stuff. And that's fantastic because that's never really, there's no explanation of that. That's just sitting there in the episode there as a little treat for the people who've watched a show that was, you know, whenever that episode came out originally, what, 20 years ago or probably longer.
Yeah, and there were tons of those. I mean, I think at one point in the episode, he says how to get attention is just say pond. And of course, you know, if you don't know anything about the other series, mm-hmm. you don't need to. If you do, of course, you know, you kind of immediately jump on it. And so if you're into it, Amy Pond is at the front of your mind. If you're not, you're just thinking that it's something to, you know, that works. And so I love that they do layer that up. And I don't think it matters that it's over the top. And I do think it's funny, especially when they make references to themselves, because it's almost like no one wants it to fail. You know, it's not like everyone's sort of barracking for it to win. And to be honest, as you say, they've kind of topped themselves so much. I really don't know what they're going to possibly come up with for the 50th, but the more I read about it.
I'm really intrigued about the new companion as well, because she's already died twice.
Twice, yes.
So is this going to be like a South Park, you know, who kills her this week? Kind of who killed Kenny? Who killed Oswin?
And she seems to know more than he does, which I think is a new thing for
the
companion.
Right.
And if you notice that in the trailers...
To say it's smaller on the outside.
And if you notice for the trailers for the second series, she keeps on changing costume, where Amy remained remarkably in the same costume while traveling with the Doctor. It does tend to give you a nod and a wink that she's going to keep reappearing and reappearing, doesn't it? But look, you know, that's exactly what the fans love doing, digging in for stuff. So obviously, tons of series, and we've had anniversaries before. We wouldn't get to 50 without them. I remember the Five Doctor special on the 20th anniversary, and I was sort of boldly doing the washing up, declaring they'd probably do the same thing for the 50th. And then one of my daughters grabbed the iPad and showed me photos of what some of the current-ish doctors actually look like. And some of them have really gone to seed. And I can tell you, I can't really see them. David Tennant looks the same. Matt Smith, all good. But yeah, go back a bit further and we start to go, holy bajingos, that guy's really not time has not been good to him. So, yeah. I don't know what they're going to do, but let's swing now just to the visual effects and discuss the work that the mill is doing. So we have to judge it by the standard of the show, I do believe, because it has to be in service of the show. So, you know, it's no point judging whether a Dalek is, you know, looking gritty and grimy enough by the, you know, the some other director's kind of feature film standard. Does it serve the plot, and is it working, or does it take us out of the show and make it look kind of daft? And so... with that in mind, we've got some, you know, pretty good characters in our in our Christmas special. But I think a good third of what interests me in this wasn't actually the visual effects. It was the makeup effects. And I wanted to just touch on that if we can, and we start the special effects section of the show. I've been really impressed at how well the prosthetic makeup team have done. And it's very evident in this episode, as it is in many, but on an episodic budget, you're not going to be able to do lots of digital touch-ups. So I've just got to believe that they're getting the makeup looking that good on the stage. And in HD, it holds up, I think, remarkably well. Zap, do you agree with that?
I do indeed agree. And especially Lizard Lady face is fantastic work. And I just sit watching it every time and going, that's absolutely beautiful how they've been able to go into every little part and add the scaly look on everything. They do cheat a little when it's supposed to be lots of the lizard people, because they conveniently wear a little plastic face mask, so you don't have to do all the detailing on the face. But for the main characters, also in some older episodes that they've been in, it's really fantastic work.
I mean, it does get you a long way there if you can get some of the main characters to have, you know, makeup that sort of is believable. I mean, in my era, and I'm going back to the Tom Baker days, there was some pretty dodgy friggin' makeup. I mean, that's just...
Ew, yeah.
Yeah, like giant... I mean, there was one character, it's like basically looked like an egg in an egg cup, and I just remember, just like, you really can't begin to make me believe that that's a character. Whereas, you know, the Weeping Angels and a lot of the other characters that clearly have a physicality about them because they're not, you know, like a digital effect like a spaceship, I think are great and suitably impressive. And if you can get that practical effect stuff happening and not require the visual effects team to waste a lot of time touching it up, they can focus their efforts where they need to do. But look, it is at a digital level kind of tough going. Ed, from your point of view, how well did the digital stuff stand up in this episode compared to that that special effects makeup? In particular, there's the attacking evil, what's her name, whatever she is, the
previous governess.
Ice governess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's probably the toughest of the digital characters to pull off. What didn't that look like to you?
It looked great to me as a total VFX layperson. I mean, they seem to use the right tool for the job. I totally agree. I think the lizard lady, I've forgotten her name, and the very funny military guy as well, that both those are sensational. And the visual effects stuff to me looked great. It's a genuine threat. It didn't seem like it's kind of a, you know, pasted on baddie. I thought that was very effective.
You're talking about in the lizard lady. We're just going to get this right because someone's going to shoot us.
I know. I already know that I'm going to get abuse.
So it's Madame Vestra, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, she looks great.
You know, full marks to them. I think it's the first openly gay character on Who, isn't it? I mean, I'm not aware of any other gay characters with her helper Jenny.
So you never watched Torchwood or Captain Jack Harkness is quite openly, oh, I'll take anything.
He's everything.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this is a spin-off show. So I guess that is very close, but inside the Who domain, am I right in thinking that, or was he openly gay when he was in the crossover part of the show?
I think he was at least hinting so extremely strongly that he'd take anything that was concave and moist. So, yeah.
Okay, good to know. the potato head dude, as I think we referred to him as, is Commander Strax, is it? I think it's Strax, yeah?
Yeah.
I think that's right. And I think we took another episode. Soltarian Commander. The webisodes earlier, the one with Strax doing Christmas carols is probably the funniest 2 or 3 minutes of Doctor Who stuff I've seen ever.
Yeah,
I must have missed that.
That's spectacularly good.
I mean, it really does help. I mean, if you're coming to this episode cold, you'd be like, what the heck is going on with these guys? Because they do seem, I think from a single episode, they seem oddly out of place in the Who sort of domain. They're completely fun to have, and the fact that no one seems particularly alarmed by them I found amusing. Again, I'm just judging it by its own kind of metrics. they absolutely did what they were meant to do. They served the story. I found them to be good kind of comic relief. Implausible, perhaps. And however he became a nurse, I missed that episode. I understand it was some huge demotion for something he did earlier. I always knew them when I was a kid as kind of evil warrior commander dudes. But apparently my daughter informs me that he did some huge thing and was made a nurse in an earlier episode. Do either of you see that episode that led to our commander being demoted?
Yeah, he apparently has some lactating glands genetically modified, so he can do that too, yeah.
Okay, good. Good to know. Good to know. But
good knowledge.
His makeup is great, and so is, as you said, the lizard lady. So in the episode, they're the obvious sort of counterpoint to the digital version that Zap, I hadn't asked you about whether you found the digital governess believable.
Yeah, both yes and no, in the sense that I do realize the limitation of episodic television and what you can do. Plus, I was actually reading the Mill blog on the topic, and they were rendering this in Arnold, and they even themselves admit to the fact that ICE is really tricky for poor little computers to understand. Even something as advanced as Arnold, you know, it scatters within and it right fractures here and there and back and forth, so they did their damnedest to make the ICE look like ICE, and I think they did in most cases a pretty darn good job, but still not like 100% convincing. For me, I really never, I mean, I'm of course a nerd in this, you know, domain, so I obviously see that is a CG thing. I don't care because I love it and I understand all the limitations, but did it sell completely 100% as actual ICE to me? It did not. Did it sell as a really cool, you know, CG as close as ICE as you probably can get? Absolutely.
I mean, I'll be slightly harsher on it. I think the problem that you've got is that you've got a material now that they've addressed this through editing with the Weeping Angels, but you've got a material that doesn't lend itself very well to movement. I mean, yep. You just don't expect ICE to bend. Now, in a mega budget film like The Hobbit, when you've got the Stone Mountains fighting, they had to address exactly the same problems, like how do they get it? And there they don't have the stone bending. They have the stone overlapping and it was fracturing. And I felt that was an incredibly believable solution to how do you get a stone mountain to articulate, fight, punch and react. But as a consequence, it was phenomenally complicated to produce in terms of the dynamics and everything else. If you tried to do this with ICE and you were on a feature film budget and timescale, I'm sure you could have found a similar approach where the ICE didn't look like it was just bending and as a consequence should have, you know, go further to selling the picture. Because if you look at a still from these episodes, as I think the Mill posted on their blogs, you know, they're not too bad. It's the movement that just crushed it for me. I just couldn't buy into it. Now, I think I'm right in saying, my guys, that we didn't really see the snowman, the evil snowman, doing much movement. It was a similar sort of thing to them basically kind of moving when your back was turned.
Yeah, they were kind of popped out of the ground and they grinned at you menacingly, which, by the way, I saw a lot of snowmen in Sweden doing after that too.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think some smart person at the BBC posted a thing you could print off of the kind of teeth. So they were all over every snowman.
But, I mean, the thing is, it is a hard task when you give a visual effects team something to do that is both, you know, you want it to be believable and you obviously want it to be lifelike, but similarly, it's sort of almost impossible to do that while at the same time making it of the material that they want it to be made of. I mean, ice moving, you know, it's not going to feel... even water is, like, really hard. I mean, The Abyss did it with great... effect way at the very start of computer graphics, but I don't know, just I find it really hard to buy an ice moving character. When she's on the stairs and she's threatening, it was a problem that I don't think the Mill could have really solved without going to the trouble of going to a full-on fracture based solution, which would have been prohibitively expensive in the...
I will have to agree completely. I never touched on the movement, but I did also think that was a problem partially for that. And I also think the animation style, I don't know if they tried to make it a little bit kind of jerky because it was supposed to be ice snapping back and forth, but somehow it didn't read as you know, as good as it probably could have been. Again, I do realize all the limitation of episodic, and they probably worked overtime already on that, and it's great work, so I'm not belittling them in any way, shape, or form. But, yeah.
I mean, the point of this show is if we're going to criticize, we have to articulate why. I think it's valid to say this was working or not working for these reasons. And I've always said this about this show. I think it's valid to say without being nasty that, you know, something did or didn't work for us, as long as you can articulate why and perhaps address the issues that are underlying that. I mean, see, for me, if you have a big epic scene, and I mentioned earlier the Dalek Asylum, which introduced the character that is the new companion first in the previous episode, it worked really well. He had a ton of Daleks there, but they weren't really moving, and so it was kind of sort of, it was dramatic. They were very symmetrical, but they're Daleks, so you kind of want them to be symmetrical because they're robotic, and you just, like, a lot of it, the effects easily played on the same story pinnings. The problem is here, the story is asking the effects team to do two things at once that are a direct contradiction, and so my criticism isn't so much that they didn't do a good job in a sense as so much as it was a very hard brief to ever crack. Because, you know, I mean, I just don't think it worked very well. I mean, it's worked fine for Doctor Who. My kids loved it. But I'll go even further. I'll say that the solution to the weeping angels, which are the statues that move but when you can't see them, produces a much more horrifying, much more threatening, and in fact much more beloved villain than does this ice governess. Because you see her moving, because she doesn't have that kind of threatening thing, you know, I think she just isn't that memorable and evil kind of character.
I think that it's interesting you're talking about the Hobbit and the Stone Giant guys, though, because for me, however technically good or bad the Ice Governess was, you know, her entrance into the room, which was, I thought was really, really well handled, was genuinely scary. And because she's kind of this, you know, human scale threat that fits within the plot, and it's scary when someone like a nanny or someone of sort of trust is suddenly evil, or, you know, she's kind of in the house suddenly. All of that contributed for me to make her a much more sort of threatening, perilous figure in there than, for example, the rock giants and the Hobbit, which just seemed like so out there that they're never really, you were like, well, this is, and we're just going to now wait for 6 minutes while this $5 million sequence happens, and then they're clearly all going to get into the next bit. So I don't know, there seems to be something there.
I just feel like from an animation point of view, I mean, I understand your plot point, but from an animation point of view, I thought it was a more successful solution, and, you know, bloody well should be. The other thing I would say is if one had been a bit more old school on this, I think you could have played much more with her in the pond. I mean, it would have been relatively easy, and it's a very old school effect, to, you just do it with water. You'd put down 2 or 3 inch pan of water, which was a glass plate. So in other words, the water sat on glass, and then you'd have the actress under the glass, which would make her look like she's underwater. I think you could have done the same thing. I think you could have built an ice top to that pond, which was clearly sitting up from the ground, had an actress underneath it looking like she was doing stuff, you know, frozen in the ice, and that could have been quite threatening. And yet we kind of quickly got out of the pond, and I thought that was a bit of a missed opportunity because they wanted to go to the sort of CG character.
But I would say that from a plot point of view, that's a really good example of something that Doctor Who does all the time, particularly in its current incarnation, which is that it sets up an expectation of where the threat is going to come from, and then twists that. So it's not, you think, oh, she's standing right by the edge, something's going to happen, something's going to come out and grab her or whatever, and that's not what happens. Actually, you think it sets up that expectation that that's where that's going to happen, and actually it's then suddenly when they think the Doctor's going to come in the room, it's the icing, and it's no longer limited to that area.
Actually, well, I've gone down this rat hole of, I don't know why, of bringing up The Hobbit, I should actually just, while if you guys could excuse me, clarify those earlier comments I was alluding to with Zap. We've gone down to a rat hole and mentioned it. So Zap, I guess I've opened the door on it. Just how badly did I hack your opinion on The Hobbit?
That might be end up being a long story. So now you treaded into dangerous territory, my friend. You don't remember exactly how much you botched my opinion, but We were discussing the high frame rate, and I find it kind of ironic that we're doing it now on a show about Doctor Who, because one of the most common things I hear is people that are saying when they watch The Hobbit, it looks like an old Doctor Who thing from the 70s. And, you know, high frame rate is not a new thing. It's what televisions have always done. Who even wins by 2 frames per second being done in 50 frames per second, or technically fields because it's interlaced, but, you know, who's counting? And this has always been perceived as television, whereas film has been perceived as film. And one of the reasons is the change in frame rate. And then people ask me, so Sap, are you telling me that, because the argument I always hear is, you know, the only reason 24 frames per second was chosen was because it was the slowest speed onto which they can put the optical audio track. And this is true. And they tell me, Sap, do you honestly think that we just lucked into some completely magic number based on this completely arbitrary thing? And I would say, actually, yes, I do think we indeed did that. Because I can go as little as up to 30 frames. I was involved in doing like a, you know, a no-profit production back in a while, which was shot on NTSC video, shot progressive, not interlaced, to look more like film, but that still just makes it 30 frames per second. And even this little difference from 24 or 25, as we do here in the PAL countries, 230 still looked, somehow had this tiny edge of cheese on it. And the big question is really why? Why do we have this perception of cheesiness? Some people tell me that this is just learned, that we kind of learned from watching TV versus film, that we learn this look is high-end film when it looks like this, and it's crappy, cheap television when it looks like that. But I really don't buy into this personally, that is just the, this might be one element of it, but I honestly think that there is something fundamental about the frame rate somewhere around the 24, 25 frames per second that does something really particular with our perception. And what exactly this is, I don't know, because as you know, Mike, on my mental ray training, MRY 201 I did for you guys a couple of years ago, I have a whole section just on perception, on how we suck at actually understanding what we actually see. And understanding our own perception, we completely fail every box, you know, cross out every box that do we understand, can we even see the actual luminance of a pixel? No, we cannot. We actually only see the difference, etc., etc., etc. It goes on and on and on. And the problem that we can't understand our own perception makes us kind of, it disqualifies ourselves to make this kind of informed opinion about these kind of things. And you have to kind of go with your feeling, like you watch this one thing and it looks cool, and you watch the other thing, it looks crap.
So what you're saying is
technically
that
it should be better.
We can intellectualize the process, but as I think I've said many times before, as my father used to say, you can read the entire works of Sigmund Freud, but sooner or later you've got to take a girl on a date. And what you're saying is that intellectually it might sound like it should be better, but our perception, we're so bad at predicting our own perceptions and where it's going to play, that it really comes down to just what you're seeing.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, take a simpler example to understand. People used to say that vinyl albums sounded so much warmer and smoother and more beautiful than CDs. And the problem is, since I used to be into music production, is this. On vinyl, you can only have so much dynamic range, or the needle will literally skip out of the groove and end up somewhere else. Which means the guy that masters for vinyl has to lay all these layers of compression. And I'm talking audio level compression, where you push the peaks down and take the low levels up, to make it actually work, to make the groove actually work, to stay away from the noise floor of the groove, but not make too big excursions so the needle actually jumps out.
But now we've got a rat hole inside a rat hole. So I'm going to swing you back to the...
No, but it's almost done.
Okay.
The thing is that it sounds a particular way, which actually plays into our perception of sound. Our perception of sound is actually logarithmic and all these things. And this compression, for some reason, sounds good to us. Jump to CDs, people say, oh, we can have all this dynamic range. Look, I don't have to compress the peaks anymore. And it turns out we actually hate the sound of uncompressed audio. We want the peaks. Do you run a little limiter on top of your podcast before you're listening? At least use use microphones. Which
we do, but I also have a vinyl LP collection, which is growing. So there you go. I have both. Yes, yeah. I have the limiter. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff. Because we don't understand it, we think it's one thing when it's really another. So there's a way to master a CD in such a way that it sounds just as warm and punchy and all these things that you want from a vinyl, but you have to know what you're doing and why you're doing it, etc. So I think it's the same that for film, that if you say just, oh, this has to be better because it's a bigger number, I had more dynamic range and I hold all these things, and it makes it more real. And the question is more real what you actually wanted? I think that is the key thing. Yes, the CD with the higher dynamic range where the kick drum actually is much louder than everything else is technically more real because that's what it would have sounded like if you had the drum set in your room. But it's actually not the sound we actually perceive as good sounding. The sound we perceive as good sounding is the more, dynamic range compressed one, the same as the image we perceive as at least more cinematic or more, is the one with the lower frame rate. And who knows why, but that's my story. And I'm sticking
to it. And you don't think it's a learned response?
I think not, because I remember when I was showing, I have this video camera I bought, which is a PAL camera. I paid extra to get progressive scan. And I was showing my son, he was only like 10 at the time, here's this switch, and you see what happens when you flip between it. And he immediately said, with no special prompting from me, that one thing you did that looks kind of cheesy. I like it better in the other setting. And that was he already at like 10, 11, on saying I way prefer the progressive look, which was 25 frames, to the interlaced, which was basically 50.
All right. Well, in an attempt to dig my way out of this rat hole I've taken us down,
I want to talk about 3D.
That's what I was about to say. That's exactly what I was about to say. Because because Doctor Who's 50th is going to be in 3D. So we're halfway through season 7. He's coming back in March with another 8 eps, with obviously Clara returning as his as his new companion, but there's going to be a whole, basically Time Lord in 3D thing, which, of course, The Hobbit was also 3D in addition to being, done with the higher frame rate. So my question to you is, do you think that you would want to see Doctor Who in 3D? Do you think that would enhance the position? Does that make the visual effects a downside more complicated to manufacture?
Yeah, it will be a lot more work for some poor people, that's for sure. But it might be interesting. I'm not sure, because one thing that I do agree with that high frame rates solve is that 3D looks less, brain hemorrhaging than it can do when you have a very juddery, if you have a very juddery pan, and on top of that in 3D, ouch. And we all know this, that this is a problem. And high frame rates solve that. The problem is that 3D plus high frame rates makes you see basically too much. You had a very good, when you talked to Jason Wingrove on the RC on this topic, you basically said something about the, you have things like lighting. It looks artificial. It was always artificial, but when it was in 2D and it was in the low frame rate, we kind of, again, is it the learned response or some layer of fairy dust? I don't know. But it looks cool. When suddenly when it's 3D, it looks more real. And then also on top of this, whoa, more frame rate. It looks actually real. But is that really what you want to see? That's the thing. As for Doctor Who in 3D, well, hit me with it. I'll tell you afterwards.
Yeah, I must admit, my pet peeve on set is when we say, well, we could do this as a green screen drop thing. No, we're going to do it all real. And I go, really? So that guy's actually going to die? That guy's actually going to shoot him with a gun? And that is actually a restaurant and not the side of the back of the studio? it's all fake. Sorry. He isn't really a Time Lord. Anyway, so getting back to the show for a second. So I've discussed what for me didn't work so well, but I do think I'd like to discuss something that I thought was both worked well, was visual effects really helping the story, and it was kind of magical. And that was the TARDIS being up off the ground from the park with the device of having to go up the kind of stairs to get to it. Ed, what'd you think?
I thought that was really great, and I'm just trying to remember correctly, but I think there was a really spectacular shot there, just a single shot that went completely around the TARDIS and then revealed her going into it. Am I getting that wrong?
Yeah, I thought the whole thing was, well, there's a couple of things that were really nice in the thing, but I think it worked well, the idea of having the TARDIS up in the air like that. I thought that was really nice. I thought there were nice shots. That idea of it being in the clouds was kind of like just, you know, because it's a kid's show, like it's a lot of adults love it, but I mean, it's, you know, it's meant to be, you know, a bit fantastical, a bit enchanting, and that I thought just gave it a real charm. And you know, the jury is out on whether the new inside of the TARDIS, with or without Gallifrey logos throughout, is better or worse since they've redesigned the inside of the TARDIS. But I've heard that debate many, many times over the years when they keep changing it. I always think change is good. But regardless of what you liked, once they got into the TARDIS, I thought the device of going up worked well at many levels, and it was just a nice sequence, and it worked well from an exterior to an interior. I guess, Ed, you'd probably be more critical on that. Did probably feel a little bit studio when they went. What do you think? But she's in the park.
A little bit, but I just thought it worked so well in terms of setting up kind of where the Doctor is kind of mentally, and that he's kind of become distant, and also just touching on this and the sense throughout the series that he's, you know, this kind of protector of Earth, and he's kind of just floating around, keeping an eye on stuff. I thought the whole ladder thing was just, you know, just a really Doctor Who-ish, Whovian, I think is the correct adjective, a device to get up there and things. Although somebody did spot that apparently the spiral staircase swaps direction halfway up. If you look carefully enough, it goes from left hand to right.
Even that is very very Whovian, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe it's just timey wimey, spirally wirely. But yeah, it was great, and I think any director or DP getting involved with Doctor Who, everyone wants to do a shot like that where you know, in a single shot, you go, you know, right into the TARDIS. I think if you did a big budget movie of Doctor Who, it would be one of the first things you'd want to do, just because it's such a central conceit of the show, bigger on the inside. So I think being able to do, if I'm remembering it correctly, that kind of track all the way around and then going in and then using the new companion's discovery of that same thing as an excuse to do that shot. So it
wasn't. Now, are you
going
to refer to her as Soufflé Girl, or are you going to refer to her as... Sorry,
I think we're calling her Oswin now as her official name.
And I truly love that she, of course, says, "Oh, it's smaller on the outside."
Yeah, so. Made me laugh out loud just for like, how has no one written that before?
Can I just call you on that one? The one line that I was stunned that no one had ever written before is in an earlier series when the TARDIS actually takes human form and says, "Look at the sign. It says." Pull to open, you always push, or something like that. And for years, the sign has had the door going the wrong way. And
I really like River Song saying, when River Song flies the TARDIS for the first time, one of the first times, that it doesn't make the kind of classic TARDIS noise, and which the Doctor complains about. And she says that it's not meant to make that noise, that's because you always leave the handbrake on. That's great.
Yes. Sorry, what were you going to say, Zeph?
You see, some guy made an alternate reality TARDIS app. So he made actually a little TARDIS prop and printed some special pattern on it. And when he viewed it through his app in the cell phone, it actually was bigger on the inside. That was kind of cool.
No, I did not say that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Google alternate reality TARDIS or something. You'll find it.
What did we think about the sequence in the which I think was primarily practical, though it's hard to tell this day, when we've got the snow inside the giant bubble kind of flying around. Now, I would have assumed that was a particle sim. My daughter adamantly said it was just a bunch of fake snow with a an air.
It was hose. Maybe it was they dug out the thing from the crystal maze with all the fans in the bottom just flapping around.
Tell me about what it's like working on episodic television now. It's a bit of a conceit, I know, because I obviously have done it a bit myself, but you've just come off Red Dwarf, and I must confess I was just hanging out with the guys because they've just been here in Sydney, and we had a great day. But episodic television and the sort of constraints of it, I've often alluded to it and mentioned it on the show before. It applies to visual effects as much as it does to production and filming. I mean, it is punishing work, isn't it? I mean, just really pushing through.
It is, and actually, I was very fortunate enough to do a day of dailies on Doctor Who last year, covering for the A-camera operator. So I'm in no way part of that team, but it was a tremendous privilege just to hang out there and point a camera around that place. But yeah, it's very, very difficult. And after Red Dwarf, I've just finished a shooting a TV series that's now on Sky Atlantic, which was comedy drama. We were doing 10-11 pages a day. I think Doctor Who's more like sort of 7-ish, I would guess. And it's really tough because everybody wants the standards to be, you know, what you'd see on big American glossy TV shows is always the kind of metric in which you're judging yourself. And that's not as easy to do when you don't have the kind of $4 million an episode. So, I mean, what I think really stands out for Doctor Who is that they're actually managing to pull that off. Like, I think their sets are fantastic. They have a lot of sets per episode. The lighting standards are very high. They don't kind of fall into a trap of kind of TV lighting and boshing it through. Everything is kind of treated very, you know, like a big drama rather than the kind of.
Let's just
TV
touch on that
series.
Briefly for a second, because it's going to relate back to lighting, green screens, and stuff. I mean, the lighting is something that, you know, we maybe don't talk about enough. The big episodic, school episodic lighting you're referring to is, you know, basically being able to light so that you can have the actors go anywhere and you don't have to sort of bring a lot of lights in for close-ups and stuff, because you just simply don't have time to do those setups. But what we expect out of a modern drama, especially for our female leads, is lovely, soft area lights that it normally would need to be, what, Ed, like really close in on the actresses to get that kind of lovely wraparound effect that is so flattering.
Sure, yeah, like big soft boxes or bounce or anything like that.
And so I think, are they doing that, you know? I mean, are they just writing? Because, I mean, on A Good Wife, for example, that's exactly what they're doing, right? They've got sets built with practicals into the set, but then they are, like, literally pulling in these massive area lights to get as close to the actors just out of the edge of frame as possible.
Yeah, sure, and that's a fantastic look, and it's a look that gets you, you know, hired. I don't really want to say too much about the day I was on Doctor Who, but, you know, they've got a bit of everything going on. They've got the practicals and they tidy it up when they can, but, you know, it's a sci-fi show, and it's kind of, you know, broad strokes and kind of a little bit comic booky, so they do a bit
I've
of everything.
I've seen some really nice lighting on Amy Pond. I mean, there are some shots of her in some of the episodes, and also some of the exteriors. Again, now you're going the other way, right? You're probably putting up scrims to try and stop the harsh light on the actors when they're in Central Park or wherever they are.
Sure.
But these are all time-consuming things to do, which gets me to the green screen, which is, if you're going to do this kind of effects work, you now have this dilemma that you really don't want to spend a lot of time on set lighting green screens. But by the same token, you don't actually have a lot of time, do you, zap in post, to deal with bad green screens, because that's going to be pretty detrimental.
Yeah, that does be pain. Lighting green screens well is an art, and I'm not sure how well you have time for that art on episodic schedules.
But you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. If you're not doing good lighting with your green screens, yep, you're just thumping the poor team at the mill or whoever is trying to kind of then deal with that, because that's going to drop back to Roto at least.
I was going to say on stuff I've done, not Doctor Who, but other stuff I've DP'd with green screens. Like, the problem I often find is just not having enough space to get the green screen far enough away. Like, if it's a last minute thing, like often on set, you know, oh, let's just drop a, you know, a roll of green screen or whatever is in behind. And, you know, as we know, the reality is if you can't get it, you know, 6-10 feet as much as you possibly can away, then you start getting spill and you can't light it cleanly, and it becomes, I've did some awful things years and years ago. Just, you know, we just had like a green screen flat immediately outside a window with just all the shadows directly on it. It was probably an absolute nightmare for people to sort out. But yeah, I guess if you're not planning ahead, you can easily screw an awful lot of people.
I think it was last season's Christmas special, the Doctor, the Wardrobe, and it's basically the take on the Witch, the Line and the Wardrobe. But they had a scene at Christmas. There's a giant box which everyone uses to go through to the alternate universe. Again, a bit like they were doing with the TARDIS, in that, you know, you are very effectively seeing through the box to the other world, and from the other box, from the other world, seeing the box and how it was interplaying. And And there's just no way you're doing that without really good green screen and quite accurate green screen at that. But yeah, I mean, lighting it, getting it even, getting it set up properly, it takes time, and it's not even just a problem of time. But I mean, you know, the requirements for lighting a green screen, like, you know, I think I heard a DP once say, no one ever, you know, should see a green screen. So if you're going to favour lighting, you want to favour the actors they're going to see, not the green screen they're not. That being said, if you're on this episodic push, you've got to try and get these things lit, the levels up on digital. I assume, are they shooting Alexa on this? Anyone know?
Yeah, they're shooting Alexa.
So Alexa's a good camera, don't get me wrong. It's a great camera, but, you know.
Though this discussion of green screens, it always reminds me, there's one of these behind the scenes on The Lord of the Rings where the visual effects people were always complaining that, oh, Peter doesn't put up the green screens and we need a green screen here. So he basically dragged them out in the field. They were shooting some horses and stuff. And to see the reality of how it was on the day shooting, and they like put up one green screen and then they were like, oh, screw it, we do it in post. Even they said, let's just fix it in post. Aim the camera.
Deakins, Roger Deakins famously hates them as well. I think, in fact, was it you, Mike, who told me a whole quote about that, which is a really great story, which I'll let you tell again if you want.
Oh, I think I've already told it on the show, which is basically, this whole idea of him having an ILM supervisor tell him he didn't have to put up a green screen, and him going, wait, what do you mean? For this shot or for the rest of my career? I'm going to get back to this point, though, is that it's all very well to say that. But, I mean, if you are the guy sitting there who's got to get the doctor set solved of a doctor or a character, a child, going through this box into the snowland, as in the previous Christmas special, you know, like rotoing a child going through a confined space into another environment because the green isn't lit well, or it's bouncing around inside the portal, as it were. I mean, these are all big problems that just take time, and I just think we're doing a disservice to skip over the fact that, you know, it's not like the mill has a ton of time on their hands. I mean, yes, there's a big gap right now in the series, but I mean, when you're punching through episodic, even on something as front of I guess the budget as this is, because, you know, this is a sci-fi show, it's on the BBC, and it's, let's face it,
I would say that in an ideal in an ideal universe, you would do the math, right? Like, this will take this much amount of time to do here on stage with the green screen, and it will this much extra work. Multiply this extra time by the number of people you have to pay to do that, and then compute exactly how much time you would need to do the work in post and how many people it would take to do that, etc. So in theory, if you had all the information, which you never do in reality, you could basically calculate for each shot. We do it here because it's too much, but we don't do it here. For instance, one child crawling through this box, I mean, I could assume you could row to that, just tell the child, you know, comb your hair better so it does, you don't have all the frizzy stuff, or set up a black background in there instead of a green screen. We could probably do it with roto and even get the frizzy stuff on the hair. So there's, you know, but reality is never like that, I guess.
I've been, for me, you know, as a DP, kind of learning about VFX through this weird window of shooting stuff and then finding out how much I've made people's lives difficult.
The
green screen thing. Well, because there is a perception from, you know, production to you guys that you guys can do anything because, you know, the evidence is in front of us. And in the chaos of production, that kind of calculation, that algorithm is very difficult to think about, and we're not experts. And what I've learned over the years is just how much difference it makes. Like, a lot of DPs will, you know, as we've said, will say, well, green screen, you know, I'll stick it in, but I'm not going to spend a ton of time making that right because that's someone else's problem. And I did a commercial last year, which was actually the first one in Europe on the F-65, and it was all green screen. It was someone dressed kind of Carmen Miranda with all kinds of fruit and crazy stuff all over her head, and in front of a green screen. And because it was relatively simple, I was able to spend a lot of time getting the green screen absolutely perfect. And we took this F-65 raw footage, which, you know, as you've discussed on the show, is, you know, kind of true 4K and everything.
Marvelous,
we took it into After Effects, and when I've watched a lot of VFX kind of tutorials about green screen stuff and keying in general, just so I could be a bit more informed. And, you know, one of the things that people always say is, oh, you know, don't expect this to be kind of a one-click solution. You've got to build stuff up, and you've got to have a key for the hair and a key for this, and you kind of combine it all. And in this case, because we had this great footage and we had time to make it absolutely perfect, it literally was. We just, you know, took the key light, you know, version one or whatever it is, it's in After Effects, clicked once on the green, and it just was flawless straight away. Just, I guess, because it was a simple shot, it was the perfect possible keying thing. And that's just, I've taken away from that, just going, well, you know, that suddenly could have saved, like, you know, 10 grand in hours if this was a complex shot. And actually, it was that easy to do it. But you're probably going to tell me it's not that easy. But
No. I mean, if shot well, you can key well. But I'll go further and say, Zap, the other big thing is that it's sort of a similar mental calculation to what you're referring to there, which, you know, sometimes you can't do, sometimes you can, is whether or not to move the camera. Because, again, in episodic television, the more you have, you know, complex 3D moves to try and do a 3D camera solution on, the longer it's going to take and the more sort of work you've got. On a normal show, you like a normal feature film, you could happily have a department, you know, doing camera tracking on every single shot and just prepping everything for geometry and doing LiDAR scans and the rest of it. And that would be not an unreasonable thing on a large kind of production. But on episodic television, you know, you get the same problem. It's like, well, it'd be kind of easier if you didn't fly the camera around a lot, because some poor sucker's going to sit there for 3 days trying to solve that, possibly with a zoom lens. Even worse if they're doing it in 3D, of course, in stereo, as they are saying they're going to do. From watching it point of view, have you ever been sort of conscious of any sort of noticeable difference in the camera work from your effects point of view? Because, okay, here comes an effect sequence, so I feel like I've gone a bit more locked off, or you feel like the camera's... I'm going to ask the same question to you, Ed, in a second, but is that from your point of view? Does it always feel the same, the cinematography, whether there's effects in it or not?
That's a pretty good question. Actually, a comment I would like to make first on that is that I think I get a feeling that the cinematography quality has kind of increased over the seasons. If you go back to early Eccleston or Tennant episodes, it didn't look as beautiful as it does now. So clearly we got a budget increase together with basically the same time we got Smith as the Doctor. We somehow got a budget increase there. I don't know if you agree with me. I think it looks nicer. And I really, by the way, hated the lens flares on the old logo. That was just painful to watch. But cinematography between effects shot, I can't really say that I thought that much about that. I do think there is its fair share of, oh, let's lock off the camera because it's easier kind of stuff going on. I kind of take that for granted, though, when you're doing episodic television, that you do that kind of stuff. It makes sense to me. I would anyway, like, okay, we stop moving the camera, please? That's what I would say.
Okay, so Ed, with your eye as a cinematographer, and I should point out Ed has done Steadicam work and all this kind of stuff as well, do you feel like the cinematography is consistent throughout? Do you notice anything when they're into effect sequences?
Well, actually, one of the reasons that I got the call to cover the Doctor Who operator on dailies is because the A-cam operator also does lots of Steadicam on Doctor Who and a lot of stuff on Crane, and they've got remote heads with wheels and stuff. So the whole show is really typified by a lot of camera movement. They've got those tools like 24/7 at their disposal. And I don't get the impression that you don't get that sort of, oh, look, it's the camera's locked off, like something's about to VFX its way into shot. I don't get the impression that they feel too limited by that, but in the way that that you can be perhaps on lower budget stuff. But I have no idea how tricky the kind of tracking solves are these days, or whether I just assume, you know, you drag the clip, the QuickTime file, into a little window and it says completely solved straight away, and you just drag that onto 3D Studio Pro 7.
Well, in exactly the same way with these modern Alexa cameras, you don't have to bother using any lighting, right? Because the ISO is so good that it can just use normal lighting, which everyone looks really good
in. You know, actually, when you say that, I think that might actually be one of the difference I am picking up when I think back to older series. Now I don't mean, you know, 70s older, but you know, the like series yep. 1, 2, 3, that there were probably more that the camera was locked off when there was an effect going on, and I don't think it's that anymore. Like for instance, the Asylum of the Daleks episode, there is a lot of the city outside when they're inside this giant Dalek statue kind of thing through the window, and they're going with the camera back and forth. You have to put in the green screen and track that in, and it didn't seem like anybody, you know, cared to set the camera on a stick there. So
Just going back to the look of the show, and I completely agree with you that I think they've done a really great job of kind of progressing it, and it now really it looks fantastic. And on the first series of the reboot was actually shot on Digibeta, and I think possibly even the second series, and there's a story a few people have told me, I'm not quite sure whether it's just apocryphal or not, that when they were started doing it to BBC Wales, they just did a deal with a local guy who had a Digibeta, and that was, you know, they, because they didn't have a ton of money, and they shot it on that, and then they were kind of, it became a big hit, and one of the US channels wanted to show it, and they were like, can you send us the HD master? And they were like, what HD master? We didn't shoot it in HD. And so and then obviously it moved on, and they moved to F35 for, I think, certainly the first one with Matt Smith was F35, and now Alexa. Whether or not the lighting budget or something has changed, I don't know. But it's certainly come on leaps and bounds. They're shooting ProRes Quad 4 Log-C, if anyone's interested. There's no codecs or anything like that.
Yeah, and I will say that Log-C format is the secret weapon that makes Alexa work in this episodic work so well. I mean, it really does make a huge difference.
I got a text from one of the camera assistants on it the other day saying they, with a close-up shot of the LCD panel on the side of the Alexa, and they'd got to real 999. They weren't quite sure what they were going to do next. They've shot so much stuff, so they may be one of the few Alexa users in the world who've reached that point now.
Okay, so that was my favorite bit of this sort of Christmas thing, that going up the stairs. Just before we leave it, is there anything that you guys wanted to sort of shout out that you particularly liked in the stuff that you saw?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you mean specifically in the Christmas episode, not so sure, but one thing I did like was these completely practical robots they used in the dinosaurs on a spaceship thing. That was kind of, I like those.
Yeah. I mean, look, I totally agree. And I can't wait for the Ice Warriors to come back in the second half. I remember the Ice Warriors from my days with much earlier Doctors. So, I think I was going to mention this on the green screen, but we didn't get back to it. But one of the things that green screen dictates, of course, into costume, and I just wanted to flag for the fact that I think that the costume work, we talked about the special effects makeup, but the costume work has also been good. I mean, the Doctor's sporting a particularly sort of, I don't know how you describe it, really. It's like a very Oliver Twisty kind of looking costume in this special. But those wardrobe team also do a good job in giving you stuff to help build whatever world that they're meant to be in, right? And it's obviously much harder to decorate people on an alien planet than it is to do something that's more like a period piece. But nevertheless, it's still really nice, the costumes that they come up with on the team. But was there something away from this Christmas episode that you wanted to flag or not?
I really, really liked kind of probably simple effects, but just really effective. I really liked the Power of Three episode with all the black cubes, which obviously I'm sure were the vast majority were, you know, practical in close-ups and not so practical further away. But that's just visually very strong image.
Yeah, that was a very very interesting episode, especially for that actually having the Doctor hang around for a while. Though again, slightly improbable, but but fun watching.
Wanted to briefly shout out to actually a Red Dwarf alum, Andrew Ellard, who is the script editor on Red Dwarf and is a screenwriter and script editor at large. And he's very worth following on Twitter if you're into Doctor Who, because he does fantastic kind of analysis of the episodes as they go on. Informed by a sort of exhaustive knowledge of not only screenwriting and kind of script structure, but also all the kind of other Doctor Who history. So he's LR Dent on Twitter, which is ELLARDDENT.
And a nice guy.
And a lovely guy.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to I don't expect it. I want K9 to come back. If that was the case, then I'd be really happy.
Ouch. No, please. Anything but that. If you want to take cheesy stuff, which I really did not enjoy in the Doctor Who, it's really when they bring back something of this super old thing, like, yeah, K9 would be one of the things that I was kind of face-palming through all that, those kind of revival episodes. I think it's the finale of season 4, I think, that we have K9 in. It's like, it doesn't really work, 2012. I'm sorry, guys.
It works fine. What are you talking about? Now, we've been talking about the Mill doing the visual effects work because, of course, the Mill was the principal visual effects house on the Snowman episode. But we've also drifted off that. So we should mention Space Digital because they worked on episodes 3, 4, and 5, I believe, of the current Series 7 that we're on. A strong London house that does, of course, visual effects work and it's done a bunch of stuff. So not to to leave them out of the loop, as it were. Space Digital, I think, are in, I'm going to say in the middle of London, but I could be wrong about that. So Mill on the Christmas special, but I don't get the impression that Mill did all of this this series. Space Digital has done some great work as well. Well, it's been great having you guys on the show. I didn't flag earlier that these guys have been coming to you from different parts of Europe. So, Ed, where are you at the moment?
I'm actually in Birmingham, just north of London. It's also very snowy here at the moment as well.
I will say that I've shot with Ed. Jason Wingrove from the RC shot with Ed. Ed's a great DOP, I presume you're not totally booked up, but where can people find you if they want to track you down? Because I've always
the best place, probably Twitter. I'm just Ed Moore at Twitter, EDMORE, and you can click through my Facebook page, which I've just made, which I'm spamming behind-the-scenes photos on of my Sky Atlantic series Common Ground, which is out at the moment.
Brilliant. And Zap, you mentioned earlier where you'd done a more detailed critique on The Hobbit. Can you give more details of that website so people can track it down?
Sure. I have a couple of blogs. First of all, those people who know me as that Mental Ray person, you'll find at mentalraytips.com. That kind of stuff. I also have kind of a personal blog where I do have this my discussion on frame rates and hobbits and whatnot. You find that at mastersap.blogspot.com. Otherwise, you can find me on the Twitter thing. It's twitters.com/mastersap. From Sweden, snowy.
And I should also point out, Zap's done a lot of work with the Nokia N900, right? With sort of like hacking and doing computational photography stuff. And you've done, I mean, not just render stuff. You've done a wealth of really interesting stuff. It's always a joy to have you on the show.
Yeah, I do lots of crazy stuff. These days I work for Autodesk in the 3ds Max group with rendering. Have a history of working at Mental Images doing Mental Ray stuff. So now it's like more all renderers than just Mental Ray, but it's still all hardcore rendering stuff.
Excellent, excellent. And I believe you've... I've just got to ask you one story. I believe at Christmas you blogged a photo of what was the largest kind of margarita stacked kind of pyramid in history, and I never got the answer to where that was or why I wasn't invited to the party. But as people will know, we like tequilas here at FX Guide. So what was that about?
No, I was actually on vacation in Egypt, and they had this New Year's ball kind of thing. And there were supposed to be cocktails in the lobby, and thought there's a bar in the lobby. So I thought it was just be normal, like go to the bar, because it was one of these all-inclusive places. So I thought it was just go to the bar and get a cocktail. But we ended up in the lobby. It was slightly more elaborate than that. So they had built this entire pyramids and stacked them with various cocktails. So there was a margarita pyramid. There was, you know, a, I don't know, whatever drink pyramid, you know, gin tonic pyramids and all sorts. So very Egyptian or not, I don't know.
So now the pyramids make sense. I was just focusing on the tequila, but I can get past that. I can get the pyramids. Okay. Well, look, it's been great having you on the show. Thanks so much, guys. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up in future episodes, as we say. So stay tuned and obviously keep an eye out on our Twitter feed, which is the VFX show on Twitter. I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for being with us. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide LLC.
Now, if you're still listening to the show, I have a treat for you. Zap has discovered useless Who trivia. So in the spirit of Doctor Who and hidden gems and Easter eggs, here is our hidden Easter eggs. Zap, take it away. What have you discovered?
So I was talking to the mill to try to get some interesting inside information. For instance, how many Daleks is ever on screen at one time? The number is 15,000 from, I believe this not actually from the Asylum of the Daleks episode, but from the series finale in earlier season. Most rendering was done in Mental Ray in the past, but they're switching over to Arnold specifically for that sequence in the Parliament of the Daleks because they had to match exactly the physical props to fill out, so they were using Arnold for this. The crowd supervisor from Lord of the Ring, Streven Regulus, is such a fan that when they wanted some Dalek crowdy thing, he said, please, please, can I come and visit? So he spent a month on the show just to be able to experience it.
He's not just more than the crowd supervisor. He actually is the guy behind Massive, the software. Like, he is the guy.
Yeah. So he wanted so much to see the TARDIS that he came up and visited. And they also won a BAFTA award for the Pompeii eruption, done with real flow, fume effects, and Krakatoa.
Wow.
So there you have it.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for those hidden gems. And now we'll officially, or maybe unofficially, end the show. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Geronimo, or should I say, allons-y?
Yeah, what he said.